today. Summer is on the way, and along with it, a lot of eating. We love our picnics and barbecues, but not all of us can partake in quite the same way. Let's revisit a chat about dietary restrictions. Back to July 2015 we go. We've gone through fat-free, caffeine-free, and other trends in food. Gluten-free is a big one, because gluten is bad stuff indeed for people with celiac disease, like our guest this hour. April Pevoteau went through some tough times before medical science finally said, oh, you have celiac disease, meaning gluten and her body just don't get along. April is a writer and editor, and she set about learning more about gluten and its avoidance, sharing her findings in a blog called Gluten Is My Bitch. There's a book by that name, too. And now another book called The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet. Go G-free in 30 days or less. April Pevoteau's on the phone with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Thank you, Jeffrey. Great to be here.
You are not one of the people going gluten-free by choice, so tell us what happened.
I am not. I would choose to eat all the gluten if I could. No, I was diagnosed with celiac disease about 4.5 years ago after being very, very ill and wondering what the heck was going on. And I was thrown into this whole gluten-free world. I'd never heard of gluten. I didn't know what in the world was happening. And as a writer, I just started writing about it and started writing about what I was learning and how I was feeling and how what the heck is going on with all of this stuff. And then came the books.
And how long before you got a positive diagnosis? How long did medical science poke and probe and finally get around to what it was?
Well, I was very lucky. A lot of people can take, you know, I think the average is 10 years for a diagnosis, but I was very lucky that I got very violently ill, and it was from start to finish probably about 6 to 8 months. And I, you know, by the time I actually drug myself into the GI doctor's office, within, you know, 10 minutes, he was like, here are your three options. It's going to be celiac, it's going to be Crohn's, or it's going to be lymphoma. So I was grateful for the celiac. I was like, great.
That earlier phrase is not one you hear every day. I was lucky. I got very violently ill.
But it's true. It's true. And you hear all the other stories out there. People have been suffering for so long and so many, you know, detrimental effects to their body and their life. I'm like, oh, it wasn't so bad for me. It was a pretty quick process.
So what was it like until then, though? What were the kinds of symptoms you were showing, and what are the general symptoms of celiac disease?
Yeah, there are so many symptoms, and mine were a little bit textbook. I had the gastrointestinal distress, I will say that.
Politely,
yes, pretty severely, like constantly, kind of all day long, and that resulted in some severe weight loss, and I lost probably about 15 pounds in 3 months, and then I was fatigued. Naturally, I was very tired all the time, severe joint pain, and then this dermatitis herpetofortis, I always say it wrong, which is like basically you think you have eczema, and then it turns out it's completely gluten-related. So, yeah, I was very attractive.
Is it like hives or something?
No, it's like flaky, dry skin that kind of hurts.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like raw skin. Yeah, it's pretty gross and pretty painful. And I kept thinking, oh, it's eczema. I don't know why I suddenly have it in my 30s, but here it is. And it was just all of these things combined until I was just exhausted and sick, and I couldn't get out of bed. And that's when I went to the ER, and they said, go to a GI doctor. There's clearly something wrong here.
And there are other variations you have in here, like gluten ataxia. That sounds scary.
Yes, that is actually what my mom suffered from, which is when there's nothing going on with the gut, and so it's much harder to diagnose, but instead it attacks your brain and actually causes really severe brain damage. And I do hear from a lot of people a celiac symptom, which is they call brain fog. And, well, I would never admit to getting brain fog. I probably had that too. But a lot of people say that this overcomes them, like they can't think clearly when they've been glutened and they're confused. And there's a lot of neurological symptoms, whether it's celiac or gluten ataxia, that's more severe.
So for you then, making the transition, first of all, just in terms of taste, I mean, it sounds like you miss donuts and croissants a lot.
I do. I really do. We need a good puff pastry that's gluten-free out there.
I haven't found one yet, huh?
Not yet. I mean, there's specialty bakeries, especially, you know, in Northern California and in Portland and around there, but they're not everywhere.
All right. So then the immediacy of the transition, though, once you find out, oh, I've got celiac disease, therefore I need to go gluten-free, it's easier now than it used to be. Lots of foods are certainly identified as gluten-free, and we can get into the, you know, whether they truly are or not, mm-hmm. down the road. But then what do you do? I mean, you feel relief that you've been diagnosed, but then what did you do to your kitchen and pantry?
Yeah, no, I was relieved, again, because I didn't have cancer or Crohn's. But, yeah, I literally went home, pulled everything out of my cabinets, and then, you know, scrubbed them down because my nutritionist, you know, made it very clear that any cross contact with gluten would still make me sick, even the tiniest amount. So I'm scrubbing the cabinets, getting rid of all the wheat flour, getting rid of the soy sauce, although I didn't realize that right away. That was a later thing that I discovered. And then I went shopping, and like a crazy person, I bought every single gluten-free flour in Whole Foods. I spent a lot of money, and then I just got to work. I started mixing flours. I started experimenting with different cakes and recipes that were my family recipes until I figured out what was going to work best for me. And now that's, I use an all-purpose gluten-free flour, which, they have some really great ones now where you can just substitute literally a cup for a cup of regular flour, and you can get some really great results.
And what's in that gluten-free flour?
There's different varieties, but it usually consists of some type of tapioca flour, a rice, whether it's a white or a brown rice flour, a starch, either potato or a corn starch, and sometimes there's some other grains that are thrown in, like some all-purpose flours throw in a chickpea flour, but I find that to be a little bit too harsh for baked goods. And sometimes people throw in a powdered milk, but that's, if you're dairy-free, you've got to watch out for that. But I enjoy cooking with that.
All right. Explain briefly the soy sauce issue.
Yes, there is actually wheat in soy sauce. It's made with wheat, unless you can get a wheat-free tamari, which I do, which is my substitute for soy sauce. I know. It's one of those things. I was eating sushi thinking I was being safe, and the next thing you know, I'm sick, and I'm like, what's happening? And I'm like, oh, soy sauce.
So did that happen a lot in the first year or so of going gluten-free, discovering things the hard way?
Yes. And it still happens on occasion. I'll assume something's gluten-free, and then I'm like, oh, what happened? Oh, somebody snuck some flour into that cheese sauce. I'm like, oh, sauces. You got to watch out for the sauces.
April Pivoteau demonstrating some of the concerns of people who must eat gluten-free diets. Her book is The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet. We'll rejoin the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. April Pivoteau discovered a few years ago that she has celiac disease, so going gluten-free in her diet is not a choice, it's a necessity. She created a blog, Gluten Is My Bitch, and from that came several books, including the Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet, Go G-Free in 30 Days or Less. That's the one that brought her to the Exchange in 2015. There are some phone calls from the original interview, but we can't take any new phone calls today. So, April, in addition to having to make your own adjustments to life after gluten, it sounds like there's a fair amount of training of friends and family. And I just wonder if you have a fair number of people still saying things like, oh, come on, a little won't hurt, will it?
Yeah, I do. It's odd, even after I've written about it and you know, said disparaging things about people who say that. Every now and then I still have a friend who will say, oh, I just barely dusted this in flour, it's okay. Or, oh, you know, the tummy ache is going to be worth it. And it's like, no, it's not just a tummy ache, and it's 100% not worth it. If it were worth it, I would be down at the Dunkin' Donuts or Krispy Kreme like every day, and it's not worth it.
So you were already a writer and editor when you got into this whole process, realizing you had celiac disease. You used to research then. So, I mean, you mentioned going out and buying a bunch of flours. What other sorts of things did you do to just sort of let yourself be more aware of the world of gluten-free?
Well, the main thing I did, and everyone should do, although I know a lot of people don't, is I met with a nutritionist more than once and then had a lot of follow-up questions from my nutritionist, because the fact is you can go gluten-free and start using all the substitutes, and then you're going to miss out on a ton of nutrients that your body actually needs to function just normally, you know, whether you're eating gluten or not eating gluten. So it's really crucial that you talk to that nutritionist and make sure that you're eating healthily even without the gluten. The other thing that I did that I was surprised by, but now I'm no longer surprised by anything, Jeffrey, but was I had to do a lot of research with medications, and you have to talk to the pharmacist. You then, a lot of pharmacists don't know if there's gluten added into something, and then you've got to call the company. And I discovered a generic form of Tylenol that I was using that had gluten in it, an additive. And so I just, you know, I have realized that anytime I don't know exactly what's in anything, I have to ask.
Are they sometimes not listed on ingredients, for example? Does it have to say gluten if gluten is in it?
No. Well, there are labeling laws now for food. Mm. Like, you definitely, like, just recently there are labeling laws for gluten that's just happened in the last year where it's been implemented. But as far as medications go, no. And more than likely it's not going to say gluten. It's going to say something else that you don't even understand what it is. So you've got to make the call.
Oh, boy. So that involves a little work for the person who's trying to stay gluten-free. We have not yet established what gluten is. Why don't we go back to that point and talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. Gluten is the protein that's found in wheat, barley, rye, and triticale, which is a grain that we don't see a lot in the United States. It's more, you find it in Europe. And it's literally the protein that's inside it, no matter whether it's, you know, ancient grains or modern processed, that's irrelevant. And it's also the thing in flour that makes everything stick together and makes the bread nice and airy and makes it all work nicely together. And it's the protein that actually causes the problems within gluten.
So not the actual starchy parts.
No, it's the protein. I know, it's one of those things. I've heard there are people who are working on, can we remove the gluten from wheat? But it's, you know, it sort of takes away the crucial job of gluten if you do that. But, you know, I'm willing to let anybody try anything.
I read the New Yorker piece about where the writer had gone to a laboratory and had seen a vial of vital wheat gluten, and it was really, really hard and couldn't be dissolved by just about anything.
Yeah. And it's really sticky, and it sticks to things, and it's a really brutal thing for those of us that it affects. And it's so strange because before I was diagnosed, I was like, how can eating a turkey sandwich make me this sick? But it is this crazy, powerful thing that affects a number of us in a very negative way.
April Pepitoe, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book, The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet. You just mentioned that even the much-lauded ancient grains, they contain gluten, too?
Yes. If the protein is there, the protein is there, no matter how it's been processed.
All right. It seems like there's a bit of an anti-gluten movement in the works. You don't have any criticisms of the people who voluntarily drop gluten, but apparently there is some criticism out there, a backlash of sorts.
There definitely is, and like I say, I don't care what other people eat, and I'm not sure why other people are so concerned about what everyone else is eating, but I do get it that, you know, when there's a trend, when there's a certain way people are eating and they're saying, I feel so great, I dropped gluten, that people who want to eat gluten are thinking they're being judged, or they think, like, these people are, you know, thinking less of them, and they're not as dedicated to themselves, or they just feel bad about themselves if people are going around saying, this is how I'm eating and I feel great and you should do it too. So I get why there would be a backlash when something is simply a trend. Again, personally, I don't care what you eat, and I don't want to spend any energy getting angry about what other people eat. But some people, you know, some people are very sensitive and some people get very angry about it. You know, that's the only thing I say is, like, the trend is great for those of us who need more options, but it also can be harmful for those of us that need to be taken seriously.
My perception would be that just about the time that you discovered you had celiac disease was about the time that gluten-free seemed to be taking off. And there are so many. In fact, I was noticing one of the underwriting announcements on the network before we came to the program for this hour said, you know, so-and-so is gluten-free.
Tito's vodka, yes. I love that Tito's. yeah, I mean, it was, I always say I picked the best time to get sick because I really was. I was diagnosed, and then within months, two different restaurants opened up in my neighborhood, one that was all gluten-free and one that served gluten-free. So I really, my timing was impeccable, Jeffrey, to get violently ill and all of that. Yeah, and it's funny because, I didn't know what gluten was before I was diagnosed, and then it was everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And, you know, even now, you know, like I said, you can walk into an Italian restaurant, and a high-end Italian restaurant, and they're making gluten-free pasta fresh for you. It's just amazing how far all of this has come. And I often say to the people who've been diagnosed for 15, 20 years or more, I'm like, I'm sorry. You guys are the pioneers and we're reaping all the benefits, those of us who are just diagnosed.
Right, they did the hard work. Everybody else gets
the
prepackaged foods. Speaking of which, though, when you talk about pasta, because I think you mentioned in the book that you turned to pasta when you thought that you were having problems from something else. So how does gluten-free pasta taste? Let's start there with the taste comparisons.
Well, it's gotten much better, I will say that. people are working hard to make this stuff taste better. There's still some pastas out there that are just not great, and they're just going to either glob up or they just taste bad. That's just the reality of food anywhere that's processed. But there are people who have worked really hard, and there's some fresh pastas that you find in the refrigerator section that are, like, nobody in my family can tell the difference. They're so fantastic, and the texture is just perfect. So again, this sort of, you know, gluten renaissance has made everything better. It's made better breads, better pastas, and I'm very grateful for that.
So say you're doing a pasta dish with just a regular sauce that you cheat, get out of a jar like I do at the store. I mean, do you have to watch out for what's in the jar as well as what's in the pasta?
Yes. If you're looking for something like an Alfredo or something like that, which I make myself rather than buy. But usually your tomato sauce, I mean, I always read labels just because this is what I do now in order to be safe. In general, you can be pretty safe with your tomato sauces and things like that, but don't ever skip reading a label just because you assume that it's safe.
You do some myth busting in the book here, and one of the things you point out is April, that gluten is not a weight loss program.
It is not. I mean, it definitely wasn't for me because, you know, I had to fill up on all
those gluten free brownies after I.
Not sure what happened there. We seem to have lost our connection with April Pevoteau. We'll unhook the phone and try to get it back again. That's a pretty tricky phone line. This is going to be our third connection with April. But April Pevoteau is the author of The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet, Going Gluten-Free in 30 Days or Less. It includes 100 simple recipes along with meal plans, tips, resources, and more. April Pevoteau discovered she had celiac disease several years ago. And began the blog Gluten Is My Bitch. She's written a book called Gluten Is My Bitch. This is the follow-up to it. April, you're back. Where were we?
Yes.
Not a weight loss program going gluten-free.
Yes. So back to that. Yes. So no, it's not a weight loss program for people who have to do it. And in fact, you can gain weight if you're substituting, you know, gluten-free flours, because there's also a higher sugar content in, say, like a rice flour than a wheat flour. So it's not. It is if you're somebody who's going gluten-free for the weight loss and you're cutting out all grains and all carbs, then yeah, essentially you're on the Atkins diet that was so popular 20, 30 years ago. And yeah, you're going to lose weight. But if you're just substituting gluten-free foods for, you know, traditional wheat flour foods, then there's no way you're going to lose weight. Trust me on that one.
Right. And then there's a generational thing here, because I know there's a perception, particularly among the people who may be part of the no gluten backlash, that this is a modern thing, and it's not.
It's absolutely not. It's, again, you know, my mother suffered from this, and I have a family filled with people with autoimmune diseases, and I have a great-grandmother that died of stomach cancer, and they suspect that she probably had undiagnosed celiac disease. It's something that's been going on for a long time. It's simply that now more doctors are aware and more people are being diagnosed. It really wasn't something in the consciousness of Americans until this century, literally like around 2000 or a little bit after that. People, physicians didn't think it existed, or they just thought it was a European disease and it wasn't something that you would find over here. And now, you know, people are aware.
Interesting. Was there some sort of ethnic thing about it? Like, oh, well, you know, can't get that if you're an American or something?
You know, not knowing exactly what they were thinking, I was listening to Dr. Fasano, who is one of the premier doctors studying celiac, and he's Italian. And he, in Italy, they'd been screening people with celiac for years and years. And he came over here to practice and to study this, and he was just shocked that we weren't doing it. And he was one of the people that brought over this idea that, hey, you know, you can have this too. So it really was a matter of people, you know, European physicians coming over and saying, oh, you're not doing this? I don't know where the idea initially came from that Americans don't get it, but it was dispelled not that long ago.
Let us take a call. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with April Pevoteau, the author of The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, April.
Morning.
Well, this is pretty much a straightforward question. You've mentioned a lot of grains here, but one you haven't mentioned is called buckwheat. First of all, is buckwheat a wheat? And if it is, is it free of gluten? And Jeffrey, I'll just take her response off the phone if I could.
All right. Thank you, Jamie.
Hi, Jamie. That's a great question, because I would assume buckwheat indeed was wheat and indeed was something I couldn't eat. But in fact, it is gluten-free, and it makes for the best pancakes ever. I make buckwheat pancakes all the time, and they are my family's favorite. I know, it's tricky. Those grains can be tricky, but it's really the barley, the wheat, the rye, the triticale.
That's an excellent question. And so what is buckwheat?
It's just another grain. It's a grain in the family of all these other rice and millet and all these other millions, or not millions, however many grains there are. It seems like there are millions of grains out there.
Right.
It's just in that same family, but it does not contain gluten.
Well, I guess the good news is that there are that many grains out there. So I guess what you're saying is that there are many more alternatives than you might have thought were possible before you had to go gluten-free?
Absolutely. There are things that I've, turned to, and like what I said, with the millet flour, I can use that for any number of, the chicken parmesan and different things like that. And then the rice flours are great for baking. There's so many other grain alternatives out there. And while they don't act exactly like wheat flour, the more experimenting and the more mixing you do, you can make it work.
So talk about that process of experimenting, though, because I know I tried to make biscuits once with oat flour because of somebody's sensitivity to wheat flour, and they came out like hockey pucks.
Yeah. I really do think when you're baking, when you're doing something that is such a traditional, like a biscuit, like a cake, like something like that, you've got to use those light sugary flours like the rice and the tapioca and use a good amount of starch. And you might want to throw in the gums there, like the guar gum or the xanthan gum, to make it stick together. Some people don't like the gums, but I always like to use a little bit. I don't overdo it if I'm baking something like a biscuit. It's just going to make it fluffier and better.
And not have it crumble down the front of you when you try to eat it?
Yeah, well, things still crumble. I got to say, we got the crumbliest foods of all, gluten-free.
All right, so you have to.
We got to deal with that.
Your clothing choices might be a little different.
Exactly.
All right, a couple of other things I want to get to in your MythBusters list, and one is the idea that restaurants know how to do gluten-free. You mentioned the two that opened near you, one of which serves gluten-free, one of which is entirely gluten-free. But in general, you've had some issues, it sounds like, with restaurants trying to provide gluten-free food to you.
Absolutely. Just because a restaurant has a gluten-free menu doesn't mean it's going to be safe. You're only as safe as your waiter and your chef and the people who are preparing the food in the kitchen, the kitchen staff. I recently ordered from a gluten-free menu, and I ordered a salad, which is naturally gluten-free and should have been a no-brainer, and it came out covered in breadsticks. I'm like, this was on the gluten-free menu. How did this happen?
Really?
Yeah, and that's just kind of the case. Even if you order gluten-free pasta from a restaurant, you have to make sure that it's cooked in a different pot than the regular pasta, because that gluten sticks on there and you're going to get sick. And it's again, even if there's a gluten-free menu, people are saying, oh, it's gluten-free, you still have to ask the questions and make sure that you're going to be safe.
All right, that whole issue of cross-contamination turns out to be a big one. So if the foods have touched at some point in either preparation or delivery, there's a good chance the gluten's going to end up in the food?
Absolutely. It's sticky. It's very sticky and very hard to avoid. I've even had a moment where somebody had a sandwich and mine was next to it on the same plate, and it's not worth the risk. I've literally gotten sick just from somebody touching a flour tortilla and then touching my corn tortilla, and then I get not as sick as I would if I ate directly, but sick, and it's not... It's no joke.
Really? Just the touching it?
Absolutely. If it's on my food and I eat it, then I'm going to get sick.
Okay. So word to the wise for those of us who are not gluten-free, don't touch the foods of people who are gluten-free.
Don't put your gluteny hands all over my food. Please.
I can see it's been helpful to maintain a sense of humor through this process. I imagine it was challenging at times.
I had to laugh because I really was like, you've got to be kidding me that this delicious food is something that's making me this sick. And it just seemed crazy to me when I first heard about it. And so I've kind of had a sense of humor about it from the beginning, just because it seemed so unbelievable that this was a thing that was happening.
Have you found a gluten-free donut or a gluten-free croissant?
I haven't. I've heard rumors of them, but I have not yet tried one that is the fluffy, that light airy. I've heard they're out there. I've heard I believe in San Francisco there's a bakery that has one, but I have not had it. I need to get it.
Huh. Yeah, it sounds like a quest, like a holy grail sort of thing.
Absolutely, it is. I'm leaving right now as soon as I get off the phone.
Another myth that you address in here is the idea that GMOs cause gluten intolerance, which is going to be a big one for our area where there's a great concern about GMOs. Mm-hmm. Would you address that?
Sure. GMOs really have nothing at all to do with celiac disease and have nothing to do with the protein that's in gluten. Like I mentioned before, whether it's a highly processed grain or one that's, you know, pampered and ancient, it's going to make me sick. That's just what it is. You know, I do maintain that for people who are compromised, like myself and other people who have issues with gluten, that the cleaner you eat, the better. Like, you want your body to be prepared for any attacks that might come its way, but that's not directly related to your disease.
April Pevateau from 2015 talking about eating a gluten-free diet. Her book is The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet, Go G-Free in 30 Days or Less. The interview from 2015 continues here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. April Pevateau misses donuts and croissants and several other food items. She can't eat them, at least not the standard kind, because of celiac disease. So she changed her diet and started a blog called Gluten Is My Bitch that led to several books, including last year's Bake Sales Are My Bitch for the parents of children with food allergies. April visited in 2015 to talk about the gluten-free cheat sheet, Go G-Free in 30 Days or Less. Since it's pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. All right, you do point out in your Mythbusters section in the gluten-free cheat sheet that you can't cheat. I mean, even as you pointed out a moment ago, somebody who's got a flour tortilla touches theirs and then touches your corn tortilla can cross-contaminate. So why is the book called The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet?
Well, the cheat sheet aspect is not about cheating on your gluten-free diet because, you know, you can't do that. It's about the idea is that you have a cheat sheet here in front of you that you can open up. It's like anytime you're panicking about what do I eat and what do I do, you've got this nice compact guide to open up and give you all the answers. It's your cheat sheet.
Got it. A real easy list to look at.
Yes.
And the list is quite comprehensive when you get into the things you can't eat. And it looks like anything that resembles bread
Yes. Is
going to be a problem for you. And as I looked on the list of things like you know, you can have fried chicken, but it can't be chicken fried with a bread coating, that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly. I fry my own chicken, but I can't usually go out to eat fried chicken, sadly, tragically.
Do you put some sort of coating on fried chicken then?
Yeah, I do. And that's where something like a nice thick flour, like maybe a chickpea or something like that, comes in handy because you can get a nice good crust going on your chicken.
Now, address going vegan or vegetarian or none of the above. I mean, this is not necessarily something you have to do with, you don't have to go vegan or vegetarian to be gluten-free, right?
Absolutely not. And there, in fact, are a lot of things like seitan that are made from wheat that a lot of vegans or vegetarians live on. It's just that it seems like the gluten-free people and the vegans, we all kind of hang out together. I find that we kind of... It seems like if people who want to eat clean and they want to eat, you know, healthy, that they kind of lean over to that gluten-free vegan area. And, you know, being vegan is pretty healthy if you want to go that direction. But vegan and vegetarian do not equal gluten-free.
You know, I forgot to ask at this point how medical science is doing with any kind of medications to address celiac disease, if there are medications that can be taken that lessen the effects on the body or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of trials going on with there are a few different medications, and that do exactly that, to lessen the effects. They're also supposedly working on a vaccine, which I'm thrilled about. But it's all very new and all very in the trial stage. But there's a pill that is designed to, you take it and then it literally escorts the gluten out of your body so you would have less of an effect. And then there are other things that people like to take to lessen the effects after you've had gluten. But we're not there yet, but people are working on it.
Good to know. As far as cuisines, are there any ethnic, national cuisines that tend to be really, really bad or worse than others anyway for folks who are trying to go gluten-free?
You know, I used to say you can't have Italian food anymore, but that has changed. There are restaurants everywhere that are serving not only, you know, gluten-free pastas, but gluten-free pizzas. I find almost every pizza joint I go to now has it, like, you know, Pizza Hut just popped up with a gluten-free pizza. So I used to say yes, but now really it's kind of a free-for-all.
Of course, Pizza Hut also just came up with a pizza that has hot dogs in the crust.
So yes, they did. They're going for it.
They truly are. Aside from any physical effects from celiac disease, I mean, how challenging was it at the beginning, and maybe still, in being the person who has the diet that's different from the other people at the table?
Yeah, it really puts a damper on your dining out for social reasons. I used to love to go to every new restaurant and try everything, and it's a bummer now. I have to call ahead, and I have to make sure I'm going to be safe, and there are times I've actually had to leave a restaurant because it wasn't going to be safe, and that doesn't do much for, you know, you're relaxing and hanging out and having a good time. And again, I'm not the kind of person that like to make a scene in a restaurant, and now I'm the only person making the scene in the restaurant, and it's not very comfortable, and, you know, but you get used to it, and the more I do it, the more I'm like, this is just second nature, let me get this out of the way, and then I can kick back and enjoy my time.
We have a couple of emails here, one from, I think it's Peter in Ashland. He says, I had celiac sprue when I was younger, but had been told it had more or less subsided. This is new, celiac sprue. Recently, at age 35, though, I've developed a series of complications, and certain foods I have found aggravate both stomach and GI. What is the recurrence rate, if any, of this disorder, and what are the warning flags or symptoms in which I should be most concerned and see a specialist, and what is the risk of cancer, either stomach or colon, from celiac disease or celiac sprue?
Yeah, Peter needs to get to a doctor stat. Celiac is not something that goes away, ever. It's a gene that you have. It's an autoimmune disease. It does not go into remission. It does not go away. So it's possible either he was misdiagnosed or he has different symptoms that aren't presenting themselves, you know, in a GI manner until now. Either way, he needs to get to a doctor. The gold standard for celiac diagnosis now is first you can do a blood test, a celiac panel, and then for confirmation, you do an endoscopy where they take a biopsy of the villi in the stomach. And if anyone's ever told him he has celiac, and especially now that he's reacting, he really needs to get that checked out as soon as possible. Because, yes, stomach cancer is something that can occur if you are not treating your celiac.
All right. Another email here from Mike in Medford, going from the grill to the bar. He says, do you know how much gluten is in an average beer? A few years ago, I had to cut back on drinking multiple pints. My stomach feels instantly full, and in the morning, my skin would swell up. I like beer, but not that much. At least we have great wine here.
Yeah, you have great wine there as well. That's switch to wine. There are, you know, some good gluten-free beers. It's not the same as the normal beer, sadly. But if he really loves beer, he should explore some of those options. And especially where you are, there's different breweries that are doing some really interesting things with gluten-free beer. But, yeah, and it also could be a wheat allergy if he's swelling up and his skin is having trouble. It could be a barley allergy or something like that. But, that's a bummer.
What about the spirits for the folks who do like to have a drink with dinner? If they're having to change dinner, they have to change the drinks as well if they've got celiac disease?
If you're a big beer drinker, you do. Again, you know, wine is gluten-free, and most vodka, bourbon, gin, tequila, those things are also gluten-free. So if you're a spirits drinker, unless you're doing something that's flavored with barley malt, those are going to be gluten-free as well. It's just the beer drinkers that are really going to take a hit here. And, you know, the good news is there are breweries all over the country and in Europe that are catering to the gluten-free. So new beers are being produced all the time, and they, just like the pasta, they're getting better.
Another email here. We got quite a flurry. Scott in Ashland writes, in case you have not covered this point already, although most commercially available soy sauce is not gluten-free because wheat is added to it in the production process, soy itself is gluten-free, and gluten-free soy sauces are now widely available.
That's true. Yes, there's wheat-free tamaris and soy. Yes, that confuses my friends a lot when I say I can't have soy sauce. And they're like, oh, you can't have edamame, then you can't have. And I'm like, no, I can have the soy, but not the soy sauce because of the processing. Yeah.
A lot of confusion then, I imagine, when you go over to people's houses for dinner. It's like, but I thought you said you know that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is hard. It's hard for people who aren't immersed in it, and I do feel for my friends who invite me over for dinner for sure.
So, into the kitchen, did you find lots of gluten-free recipes already out there?
I did. But the one thing I found, and the thing that I do differently, is everybody who had a gluten-free cookbook came up with their own flour blends and their own flour mixes. And I just felt like I didn't really want to come up with my own flour blend, and so I embraced the all-purpose flours that also were just coming out as I was diagnosed, like the Cup for Cup and the Better Batter and King Arthur's, that made it easier. It made it easier for people who just wanted to get in there and make a cake rather than buy five different flours and hand mix them together. So that was available, but I was looking at the let's make it easier and let's make it more fun.
We waited long enough to talk about cake, and in fact, the picture on the cover of the gluten-free cheat sheet is a picture of a very yummy-looking chunk of chocolate cake. Tell us about that.
Chocolate cake. Oh, my goodness. I've got more than one chocolate cake recipe in this book, by the way. I began with my grandfather used to make this amazing devil's food cake, which is exactly what that cake looks like on the cover, and I've since adapted it to a bourbon and coffee version, which I have in the book, the Bourbon Joe chocolate cake, which is my favorite cake in the entire book. And I also have, for people who are very interested in healthier versions, I've got a chocolate beet cake where I never thought I would eat beets, but I will eat beets in this chocolate beet cake. it's important to know that you can have a really delicious cake when you're feeling deprived.
I think you just answered a question I was forming about what is the oddest thing that you have brought into your diet as a result of going gluten-free. It sounds like making a chocolate cake out of beets is probably right up there.
Beets in your cake, yes, it's true. I've added a lot of vegetables and a lot of things that are good for me because, again, if you have celiac, you're suffering from a vitamin deficiency, and you've got to add it in wherever you can.
So what kinds of other vitamins and supplements do you end up taking that you didn't before you were diagnosed with celiac disease?
Yeah, I wasn't someone who took any vitamins before, so it's all brand new. But I definitely have to take a multivitamin, and I need to be very careful with my calcium because it is, again, it's untreated celiac can lead to osteoporosis as well. And anytime I get accidentally glutened, you know, it's taken a hit on my system. So those are the main things that I'm taking right now.
Now, in terms of having food available anytime, any place, what kinds of snacks do you carry with you?
I carry lots of like mixed nuts, like almonds and things like that. And I also always have a gluten-free cracker on hand because you can turn that into a sandwich or dessert anytime. And I have. And in my house, I've always got a gluten-free pasta because at the last minute, you're going to, you know, sometimes you just need to throw something down on the table, and that's a really easy way to go. And, of course, fruit, vegetables, all those naturally gluten-free things you keep around as well.
Are you carrying a larger purse than you used to, April?
Oh, my goodness. Every time I travel, I like to take a picture of what I call my emergency bag. Every time I travel, I post it. I'm like, look at everything, all the food I'm carrying with me.
You mentioned nuts in a recipe just now, which reminded me about one of the items on the 30-day meal plan is Brussels sprouts with pistachios, which raises the question, can you be both gluten intolerant and develop diverticulosis as well?
Hello?
Oops. Is it? No, okay, we lost her again. This is an interesting phone line we're dealing with today. So one more time, we will turn around and get April Pevito back on the line for the few minutes we have left here on the Jefferson Exchange. April was diagnosed with celiac disease about 4 or 5 years ago and set about changing her own life because she had to go gluten-free in a hurry and letting the rest of the world know about what it was like going gluten-free as well. She's written a blog called Gluten Is My Bitch. There has been a book by the same name, and she follows that up with the gluten-free cheat sheet. And here she is back again on the most annoying phone line in the world, April.
I know. Somebody in Oregon does not like me, I think.
I guess so. Well, it's like four times now. But anyway, nuts. Any intolerance to gluten sometime compared with diverticulosis?
Well, that's not something I've directly heard or read about. It's an interesting concept. I mean, I do think that when people start to have like an autoimmune disease, then, you know, anything can happen. And I do know that people who are a lot of times sensitive to one thing can develop a sensitivity to something else.
All right. So, and then I noticed that there are several recipes that call for sweet potatoes rather than regular ones. Are there any gluten issues with regular potatoes?
No, not at all. It's something like sweet potatoes have so many nutrients, and they're just a better source of vitamins than a regular potato. Even though I eat plenty of regular potatoes, believe me, I like to add in foods that are just to give you a little bit more of a boost.
What were some of the hardest lessons to learn about gluten-free ingredients and how they act and how they handle in the kitchen?
was definitely the way the flours are so different from a wheat flour. I would think in the beginning I was like, oh, I'll just substitute and it'll be fine. But the fact is you've got to tweak it and you've got to maybe add a gum or maybe add more baking soda to make something rise. And the other thing, the very sad thing that I learned the hard way was you can't eat the cookie dough anymore. The cookie dough does not taste the same as the cookie dough did before. And then you're going to get this gross taste in your mouth from like the gums. And then once the cookies are done and they're delicious, you're not going to want it anymore because you tasted the bad cookie dough.
All right, but the cookies themselves, once they're finished, taste okay?
Fantastic. It's just that aftertaste of the gums before it's cooked, you don't want that in your mouth.
Does anything taste better in the gluten-free world you inhabit now?
You know, it's funny you say that, because while I would argue, because I've been forced to go gluten-free, that everything is really better, you know, that the original version, my husband and my daughter now, they order gluten-free pizza wherever we go. They like gluten-free pizza better than the regular, which I don't get, but I'm like, they like the thin crust. That's their thing. So I'm like, all right, more power to you.
The 30-day period you set up in this book, the gluten-free cheat sheet, is 30 days about what it takes, you think, based on your own experience, to get acclimated to the gluten-free world?
Well, the idea behind that was, you know, they say any habit is hard to break, and 28 days will give you that. And I'm like, let's give you a couple of extra days just to finish out the month. And I just wanted to have a really solid amount of time and recipes and meal plans so people could feel like they had a huge chunk of information and action plans when they needed it.
You've had some fun with this, it sounds like. I mean, and as we pointed out already, a sense of humor certainly helps in a situation like this.
Definitely. And I got to tell you, this book, it's the best thing about this book and writing this book was I now have all these recipes that I know and love. And if I forget like what I want to have for dinner, I can open it up and figure it out. It's the best.
We have barely talked about the recipes. There are many of them in the book. There's also meal plans and all sorts of tips and resources. It's called The Gluten-Free Cheat Sheet. April Pevitot wrote it and joined us today in The Exchange. April, thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.